We're talking with Jim Goodall, mostly about his new book about the SR-71 Blackbird. It's beautiful. This book is a great coffee table looking book because of all the great photographs, many of them previously classified, never before made public. You should check it out if you have any interest in secret projects and airplanes in general. You know, in addition to the SR-71 and the B-2 stealth bomber, Jim has written about several other classified, highly classified projects. The F-117A, the stealth fighter, and similar projects, many of which were developed out there at Area 51. So the question is, what else does he know about? You know, we hear these stories about, is there an SR-72? That's what some printed reports have suggested. What about the Aurora? What about the TR-3B? I've heard stories that the folks out at Groom Lake are building something that basically is invisible, not just invisible to radar, but something that could turn invisible to the human eye. So we'll get into that, talk about Ben Rich and some of the strange sentences that he expressed about something even more exotic than the projects that we're talking about. We'll be right back. So, Jim Goodall, you said you think this might be your last book about the Blackbirds. What if you were to learn there's an SR-72? Would you be writing another one?
Then I have to start the project all over again.
Do you think there is one?
Well, you know, my conversation with my friend from the Skunk Works that I was with this last Monday, I asked him, and he said he knows most of what's going on in the Skunk Works. I asked him, is there a replacement for the SR-71? Is there something out there that flies, that Lockheed is involved in, that flies higher and faster than the SR? And he said, and he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, not to my knowledge. So, is there? Well, let's put it this way. The Skunk Works employs 5,000 to 6,000 people. They're not making replacement panels for the F-22 or the F-35. They're doing something. But like my friend from the Skunk Works, and I don't know his name. He's very well known, but he said, we're fighting a different war. We don't have a strategic enemy. We don't need strategic assets. We're dealing with terrorists and ununiformed armies in third and fourth world countries. And he says it's a different game. But are we developing stuff that's really exciting? He said, yeah, in most cases, yes.
I guess from a technical standpoint, Jim, you would be able to address this certainly better than I could, but do we need one? Would we need something like that, or can we get away with satellites for doing this kind of stuff, dealing with terrorists?
Satellites are predictable. Every morning in Area 51, when they're out there flying special project stuff, they sit down and have a briefing first thing in the morning, and they say, okay, between 0730 and 0748, there's going to be a certain type of reconnaissance satellite's going to overfly Area 51. So we have to keep everything inside. If there's something on the taxiway and satellites coming, they haven't been able to take off yet. They have what they call scoot and hides, where they can, there's actually a portable shelter that's on the side of the taxiway, where they can divert into to keep the satellite from seeing them. And there, I mean, a number of years ago, some character of Popular Mechanics, not Popular Science, but Popular Mechanics, said that Area 51 was closed down. Well, you look at Google Earth, and there's all sorts of new buildings, there's new runway, there's new hangar space, new ramp space. Is there stuff going on? Hell yeah. I was out with Stuart Brown, and we went down the 10-mile road by Rachel. We pulled off into the back road to the Groom Mine, and in less than 10 minutes, we had a white pickup truck with guys in it following us. We saw them coming. We turned around and headed out. And so there's still, if things weren't so tight security-wise, I doubt seriously would have come after us. I'm 73 years old. It's not as easy for me to go camping out in the desert anymore. I mean, I can get on the ground and get in a sleeping bag, but then getting up and standing up is another problem.
What about Aurora? You know, those stories about something like Aurora, it was a budget item that was mentioned years ago, around the time I started working on stories about Area 51. Do you think that ever existed?
Yes, and I think it still exists today. The reason why I mentioned it to Ben in a conversation, and he didn't say I was full of baloney. I mentioned it to people who gave him my theory what Aurora was, and they didn't snicker or say, yeah, that's your idea. They just sort of, no comment. And the reason, and what my theory is, that the Aurora was designed for a nuclear deterrent. It was designed to track nuclear materials from the failed state of the Soviet Union. There were a lot of so-called suitcase bombs that went unaccounted for. And there hasn't been any nuclear dirty bomb set off anywhere, in the world since the end of the Soviet Union. And what I believe, and again, no one has said you're wrong, that Aurora is launched to overfly the former satellites of the former Soviet Union, keeping track of nuclear material.
So it's a sensor platform kind of a thing.
Yeah, back as early as 1974, the Navy had the ability in special P-3 Orions to overfly Soviet ships and determine the amount of fissionable material on that warship. And that way they could determine the number of weapons or maybe the total yield if they were to let them all go. And I believe that same type of sensor was used in Aurora. Now the Russians want to keep track of rogue agents and rogue nuclear scientists from building a bomb, like in one of Clancy's books. So I believe they've given permission. I'm sure they asked ahead of time, given permission for overflights. You take off on a mother airplane from Area 51. It could be like a B1. You get up to about Mach 1.7. You can start the Aurora up and it's combined cycle engine. But you don't launch it until you're about 400 miles off the coast of off the Barents Sea, on the northern part of Russia. Then you launch it. It goes up to 140,000 feet. At Mach 12, and I say Mach 12 for a reason. You overfly the breakaway republics, Belarus, Georgia, and the Ukraine, and over Iran and Iraq. If you have to recover, you can recover in Diego Garcia. Ben told me there's no difference in no increase in danger of refueling with liquid methane versus JP-4. So does that exist? Yeah. And it wouldn't cost that much money in today's world, where I'm sure the Saudis may have contributed some money over the course of 6 or 7 years of development. It wouldn't take $10 or $12 billion to do something like that.
Would that explain these giant floating triangles that people were seeing in the 90s? You know, they would fly over highways and into and in and around military bases, or do you think that?
No, I think so. Those are the other guys looking to see what we're up to. The ones that don't believe
not the Russians
coming across the southern border, but those coming from elsewhere.
What about TR-3B?
Back, I have to say, early 90s, a gentleman who I met at Nellis spent 10 years in security at Area 51. And he said they had 16 projects they were working to declassify, show to the American public. Four of them were manned, two of them were operational. Now, the non-operational, of the manned ones, you have Blue, you have Tacit Blue, and you have Bird of Prey. But there's also, I think by... when I talked to him, Ham Blue had already been acknowledged, so that wasn't in the mix. So you have Tacit Blue and Bird of Prey. That counts for two of the four manned vehicles. We haven't been sitting still. I gotta believe that. In my heart of hearts, I gotta believe that Lockheed and Boeing and Northrop Grumman and everything else and their best engineers have been working hard to develop that fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth generation platform to keep us safe.
You know, the two books that you've got out, the Blackbird book and the B-2 book, also represent sort of a different corporate approach. The Blackbird, of course, a Lockheed Skunk Works project, B-2, largely a Northrop project. You wrote in those books that it was a much different approach, even though you have friends at Lockheed and relationships there, and they would share some information with you when it comes to use of the FOIA to get records or photos. Lockheed and their friends at the Pentagon made it as tough as possible to get you to squeeze anything out of them. And Northrop was very different. But I guess my question deals with FOIA as a tool. I mean, there are limits to it. If they want to keep it secret, they can keep it secret.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I got hauled into a security office at the Pentagon during Desert Shield and Desert Storm because of my F-117 book had been out about 6 weeks. And I went to get my permanent Pentagon pass, and I had a flag on my security clearance. Now, I had the same clearance as my wing commander. I was the wing historian. And so I know exactly who the person to talk to. So I called up, his name was Pete Ames. I called him up, Deputy Director for Program Security for Special Projects. I asked Pete, I said, where you at? He said, and you're screwing with my clearance. Oh, no, I'm not. I said, well, yeah, you are. You know, someone had to put a flag on my clearance. Are you located at the Pentagon? And he said, yes. I'm in 5D-156. Now, they've changed all the numbers now, so it's probably in the same location, but it has a different number now. So I said, we got to talk. And that we did. I met him I was supposed to meet him at 1:15. I got there at 1 o'clock. I hit the buzzer on the cipher lock. The door opened up, and the young lady behind the desk, and I'm in my uniform. At the time, I was a tech sergeant. And I said, I'm Jim Goodall, here to see Pete Ames. And the woman's jaw about fell off, you know, about hit the top of the desk. And for 15 minutes, I had a parade of people coming in. Oh, you want to see what Jim Goodall looks like? Jim Goodall's here. And I went round and round with Pete, and I said, Pete, you don't own anything. This is owned by American taxpayers. And if it's not classified, then I have a right to see it. I have a right to request it. Just because you have your own little, we gotta keep the secret as long as we can. And most of the time, secrecy is about funding. It's not about the technology involved and stuff I was looking for. And I've made so many FOIA requests that have just I've never heard back from them, and it's frustrating. Or saying that the items you're requesting do not exist. Well, damn it, I know they exist. I have bits and pieces of paper that say they exist from declassified stuff from the CIA or from Air Force. So it's frustrating, and especially when my goal is not to give aid and comfort to the enemy. My goal is to preserve history. I write books to make the people who worked at Boeing, who worked at Northrop Grumman, who worked at Lockheed, who worked at Electric Boat, to look at these books and be proud of what they did. And I'm proud to write about it.
Well, I'm in the same boat, sort of, in stories that we've done about Area 51. I mean, the men and women who toiled out there in obscurity for years, couldn't even tell their own spouses what they were doing. It was long, hard work, and, there were a lot of pressures from it. But they helped win the Cold War. So some of them got mad at me for doing stories that shined a light on the base. But in the long run, they were proud of the work that they did, and Americans should be proud of what they did because they kept us safe for a long time.
I mean, and that's why I do what I do. That's why I go out and I've spent over 90 nights either at the fence line at Tonopah Test Range or the top of the Groom Range or somewhere near Rachel, looking and waiting for something weird to overfly me. And I'm first time I photographed an F-117 out of 36 exposures, this is before digital, I only had two that weren't blurred. It was like me being 12 years old and seeing a naked girl for the first time. My body was just surging. I mean, I could not, I was trembling. It was so exciting.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned Ben Rich a couple of times. Ben Rich, of course, was a legendary engineer, Skunk Works guy, who, along with Kelly Johnson, helped develop the kinds of amazing technological platforms that we've been talking about tonight. And you got to know him pretty well. In the in the years since he died, there are people, revisionists, who don't want the things that he has said to you to be true. So they've sort of rewritten it. Can you share with me? Because, I mean, you know, we're talking about projects that make George Lucas drool, statements that Ben Rich supposedly made in public about, we have the technology to take E.T. home. That sounds pretty exotic, and it seems like he's dropping a hint. Can you share with us what he told you and what you think he was trying to say?
Well, let me, based on the fact that Ben Rich, and I don't know how I got on his friend list, but Ben and I talked at least once a quarter for 25 years. And probably the second most significant phone call he ever made was August of 89, when he called me at home when I was still living in Minnesota. He said, Jim, it hasn't been made public yet, but the Blackbirds aren't going to make it through Congress, and if anybody could scrounge one, you can. Hence, that's why the Minnesota Air Guard got a Blackbird. But 10 days before he died, I called Ben. He was at the USC Medical Center, and he was talking about the Aurora. We were talking about the Aurora, and he said, you know, I'm disappointed in John Andrews. And John was my dear, dear friend who was the kit developer for testers when he came out with the SR-72, or SR-75, I guess it was, and the Aurora XR-7 penetrator. He said, I'm disappointed in John's Aurora. I said, why is that, Ben? He said, a methane liquid fuel Mach 12 airplane, it would have to have at least four times the physical internal dimension, or the thing would run out of, you know, once you took off from Area 51, or you would always say the test site, it would run out of fuel over Pasadena. So it must be bigger. So Ben told me that Aurora flies at Mach 12. Ben told me that it's fueled with liquid methane. He also mentioned that refueling cryogenic fuels is no more dangerous than JP-4. So during the same conversation, Ben said, Jim, we have things out in the desert. Now, this is a direct quote, Ben Rich to me. We have things out in the desert that's 50 years beyond what you can comprehend. Now, if you've seen it in movies like Star Wars, and I said, not what you think you can build 50 years from now, but what you can comprehend. And just think about that for a second. I can think some pretty far out stuff. And then he said, if you've seen movies like Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort. I said, Ben, you want to expand upon that? He said, no. And he died 10 days later. So, based on the other people I've talked to, I know in my heart of hearts, I have to believe Ben. And Ben also wrote a letter to John Andrews dated June of 86.
Yeah.
John had written a letter to Ben, said, Ben, do you believe in UFOs? And there's two categories, both man-made and extraterrestrial. Ben wrote back on his corporate letterhead as president of the Lockheed Advanced Development Programs. And he was in longhand, and he said, both Kelly and I are firm believers in both categories. We refer to ours, and he underlined UFO, on unfunded opportunities. Now, an unfunded opportunity means that you didn't pay for it, the American taxpayer didn't pay for it, it was given to you. But he said, beware, there are people out there that could do you harm and lead you astray. So Ben mentioned in 1986 and again in 1996 that there are things out in the Nevada desert that would blow our minds. And he didn't say Nevada. He just said out in the desert.
Well, we know what he means. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to get into Bob Lazar, S4, because you knew Bob Lazar before the world knew Bob Lazar. and had a ringside seat to the events that unfolded there. We're sort of learning how the Blackbird and other projects flew out of places like Groom Lake and Edwards Air Force Base. As I mentioned, Jim Goodall's two new books are filled with once classified photographs taken on the ground in places like Groom Lake, Area 51, and other facilities that we never get to see. And I wouldn't have imagined that these kind of things would ever be made public. But if you take a look into these pages, you can see what it looks like from ground level at these legendary facilities. When we come back, I want to get into a conversation about Bob Lazar, S4, some of those stories that Jim heard before the rest of the world heard. He heard it in person. And then we'll open up the phone lines with your calls and questions and comments. We'll be right back. Jim Goodall, before we leave the topic of Ben Rich, you know, people have interpreted statements that he has made, both the things that you have reported and then public statements that he allegedly made, as a suggestion that that we got help with some of our most advanced technology, that maybe our ability to go to the stars that he referenced in connection with black projects, that maybe we got technology from somewhere else, his belief in UFOs, both ours and theirs. Was he saying something else? Is it too much of a stretch, or do you think he was talking strictly about terrestrial technology?
No, he was talking. I mean, if you've seen movies like Star Trek or Star Wars, and we're talking about people other than human beings as we know it. And Ben was supposed. I have it in writing, and my buddy Michael Schratt has the original letter. I'd written a letter to Ben asking to do a taped interview, no holds barred interview, and he agreed to it, but he said, I have to wait till my book with Leo Janos comes out. And by the time the book was hitting the bookshelves, his health had failed. But he told me that if we do this interview, I don't want you to release it for at least 10 years after my death. So Ben was telling me the best way he could without getting in trouble with the security people, which he did a lot. Ben would say things that you want you to say, what was he trying to infer? And he said, drive the security people nuts. But he was trying to tell me with the letter to John, with his comments over the years, that we're not alone.
You know, on the day they took the wraps off the F-117, the stealth fighter. It was here at Nellis Air Force Base. They had a little ceremony, and there's Ben Rich standing in front of the plane, and they allowed me to interview him. So I had him talk about the plane and what an amazing achievement it was. And then toward the end of the interview, I asked him, you know, I said, you know, there are stories floating around about things that happened at Area 51 and Groom Lake that we had help, that we got some technological help from somewhere else, UFOs. And he stops for a second, and he kind of got a wry smile on his face and paused. And he said, nope, just good old American know-how. But he got a kick out of a question. He'd obviously had thought about it before, but he wouldn't tell me what he had told you. At least he wouldn't hint that way.
But he knew he was dying. I mean, he had 10 days left when he made that statement. And I wish... that I would have pushed him to get there and do the taped interview. And I was going to put a old standard analog clock with a sweep second hand behind him, so you could see that there was, you know, the video was not altered. It was not cut for him to, you know, say things he didn't really mean. But he was, you know, I don't know how I became on his list of good people. And I'm forever grateful to Ben and to Lockheed for giving me something to focus on for the last 50 years.
You got to know Bob Lazar. And I should point out to the audience, you're not a UFO guy. You're an aviation guy, an aerospace guy.
Right.
You chase secret planes.
Yeah,
you chase secret planes and photograph them and write about them. So you're not a UFO flying saucer guy, but you've crossed paths with that topic, whether you liked it or not, over the years. And one way you did that is the Bob Lazar story. Tell me your take on that.
When I first met Bob Lazar, he had not gone to work out at S4 yet. And John Lear and I had we were going on a trip around the Nevada test site. And we were near Scotty Junction on US 95, and an F-117 flew right over us. Now, no one had seen it other than that really, really bad picture that they showed from the tanker that was overexposed and used a wide-angle lens, I mean, a telephoto lens to squash the length of it. I mean, it was a terrible photo, but this thing flew right over us, and John and I about drove off the road. Well, we went to the fence line at Tonopah Test Range, and I was able to photograph an F-117 with a T-38 in chase. Now, they wouldn't give the dimensions of the F-117, but everybody knows what the dimensions are of the T-38. So we were able to figure out how big it was. But when I was shooting print film, this is 1988-89 time frame, and made it back to John Lear's house about 9:30 at night. All the photo mats had already closed, and I really wanted to see if any of these pictures turned out. And John told me, so I have a new friend coming over. I think you'll find him interesting. He's a physicist. He used to design nuclear weapons. And over comes Bob Lazar. And I told him what I had just photographed, and he said, well, I have a film processing unit at home, because I helped some friends who were realtors when I processed their film for the MLS. So we jump in his car and we're heading over to West Charleston. And Bob looked at me and he said, you know, I feel sorry for Lear. And I said, well, why is that? He said, the guy believes in UFOs. He said, I'm a nuclear physicist. If I can't prove it mathematically or put my hands on it, it doesn't exist. And he's such a famous aviation family. How could that be? Well, the next time I saw Bob Lazar, he had already spoken to you. That was about 6 or 8 months after I had that conversation with him, and he was working at S4 at the time. And the thing about Bob, it's been 25, almost 30 years. It's been 30 years.
Almost.
since he was out there. His story has never changed. If he had just enhanced it a little bit, he would become very wealthy. But his story has never changed. I saw his diploma from MIT at his house. This is before he went to work out in the desert.
Do you think there is an S4 or was an S4?
Yes. There's a guy I met because of the F-117 who was one of the very first Air Force guys to be on the program. He was there when they were putting together the first airplanes at Burbank. And he spent over a year and a half during flight test at Area 51. And they had their line badge or their security badge. It was good for the Nevada test site, the entire perimeter. And they had the absolute highest clearance being at Area 51. And it was a quiet day. They had access to a Humvee. And I won't give his name. I don't want to get him in trouble. But he knows who he is, and I know who he is, and he's not full of it. He's telling the truth. And he didn't know what my relationship was with Bob was, and he didn't know anything about S4. I said, well, what would you do on the weekends if you didn't go back to Vegas? Oh, well, we'll jump in Humvee and we'll go explore. And we were going around the Papoose Range, which is the backdrop to Area 51, and they came out to the southwest corner of it as you're going around it, and there's this lake bed. And I just, there was a road going there. It didn't look like it was traveled that much, but there was a road going there. And they're sitting there out of their vehicle. They're doing something. And out of nowhere came a half a dozen guys in black fatigues. Now, this guy didn't at the time know what my passion was, didn't know, he knew he was doing stuff in the F-117, but he didn't know anything about my background or anything. And he said, these guys came out of nowhere. There's no vehicles, heard no noise. All of a sudden, they were there. I said, what are you doing here? And they had their hands in their weapons and showed them the badge. They had reason. It was okay for them to be there, but they didn't want them there. And they told them, I don't want you around here. You leave right now and don't come back. And they turned around and left. And this is the dry lake bed, at the base of the Papoose Range that Bob described. That's where S4 is located. Now, where do these guys come from? why did they chase him out of this dry lake bed when the real secret stuff, according to common knowledge, was on the other side of the mountains there at Area 51? So Bob has not enhanced or done anything to what he did. And I believe in my heart of hearts, Bob Lazar is who he says he is.
Thank you. Let's take some calls.
And the people, the, you know, if Teller had hired him, like he said, and he was a con man, and not what he had, you know, not who he said he was, all Teller had to say is the guy's a fraud. He's a jerk. I don't know who the hell he is. Their response is no comment.
Right.
You can't comment on something that's classified. You can either confirm or deny it. So there's just no comment. But if he wasn't part of the program, they would have said, that guy's a charlatan. He's full of baloney. He's trying to make a quick buck. And that wasn't the case. So is Bob Lazar who he says he is? In my opinion, and I can't say I have a real good handle on personality. I've been married 3 times, so laugh.
Let's take some calls, Jim. First time caller, sure. Victor in Banning, California. Hi, Victor. You're on with Jim Goodall.
Well, hello. Actually, I was stationed at Beale Air Force Base in 1969, and we had SR-71s as part of our security. At that time, I was a security cop. Later got into law enforcement, but while I was there, became friends with the crew chiefs, and they would tell me that they would fly out at 7 a.m. and be back before noon, and they had gone to Japan and back, so I don't know what that speed is. But also while I was there, Jimmy Stewart was in the Air Force Reserve, and he flew an SR-71 co-pilot plane. It had a dual canopy, and also Barry Goldwater.
Model, yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And the SR-71 was priority C, if you're familiar with Air Force terms. In Strategic Air Command, priority one was the B-52. Priority two, or C, was the KC-135s. This was a low priority at the time because I guess they were just flying reconnaissance. But that's my story, and just thought, you know.
Thanks, Victor. Appreciate it. Jim, you as the phrase you use is you scrounged an SR-71 and got it to the Minnesota National Guard Museum, and you flew in it, in a sense, right?
Yes, I have, and Ben Rich got a big kick out of this. When Ben told me in 1989 that the Blackbirds weren't going to make it through Congress, he said, if anybody can scrounge one, you can. So I went to my boss, who was a two-star. Now, mind you, I'm a tech sergeant. I'm an E6 at the time. I went to General Schwab, and he said, General Schwab, I think I can get a Blackbird for the Minnesota Air Guard Museum. And he laughed at me. I said, sir, give me the rather than laugh at me and say no, give me the opportunity to fail. And he said, all right, smart Alec, how are you going to get it here? I said, I already have that covered. He said, what do you mean? Well, in the Air Guard, you can violate the change of command without getting in trouble. In active duty, you know, they'd hang you out to dry. But I called the adjutant general of the New York Air National Guard. It was Paul Wagner. And then I call him up. His secretary answered the phone. He says, Sergeant Goodall with the 133rd. The general in. He said, yeah, hold on, I'll connect you. So Paul got on the phone, and I said, sir, this is Sergeant Goodall with the 133rd. He said, well, how can I help you, Sarge? I said, would the New York Air Guard be interested in moving the world's fastest airplane in a couple of your C-5s? It was dead silence for a few seconds, and he said, you mean the Blackbird? I said, yes, sir. He said, when you're ready, you call Will Hall. And I said, those are exact words. And he said, well, this will be training for moving outside cargo. He said, well, how many airplanes do you need? And I said, I could use 2. He said, well, when the time comes, you let me know. At the same time, Arne Gunderson at Pratt Whitney was hoping to get a Blackbird for West Palm Beach and put it on almost like a wind vane, so when the hurricanes came, they would be facing into the wind. And he asked the Air Force, because we were talking together how to move it. He said, they talked to Air Force and asked if they could lease a C-5. And they said, yes, it's $967,000 a day plus gas, but sure. So I've scrounged two C-5s for 8 days each. And they got, and to top it off, I scrounged a Blackbird in the process. But after we, on October 27th, 1991, we loaded the A-12 number 6931, number 128, the eighth production A-12. We rolled it into a C-5, New York Air Guard C-5. We had an inch and a half of clearance on the floor. The wings were cut off about wing station 112 outside of the main landing gear. So it was on its own landing gear. Put it in. We took off from Palmdale. We didn't have gas, so we had to go up to Travis, spend the night, fueled up, and we took off the next morning, the 28th of October. So we're out about 40 minutes, and the loadmaster's going to go downstairs and check the load. And normally, if you're just a passenger, you can't go down there when it's in flight. And I say, hey, can I go with you? And he said, well, since we're doing this all because of you, sure. So I climbed down the ladder and went up to the landing gear, climbed up the landing gear because the wings are cut off, walked down the chines. The canopy I had blocked open with a wheel chock because the counterbalance was empty of nitrogen. I had already put a 5-gallon bucket and a cushion in the ejection seat. So I actually got in the cockpit, closed the canopy, and I'm in there for about 45 minutes. And I was like, they're wrapping the bottoms. Hey, we got to go back upstairs. So we went back upstairs. And then we're about 30 minutes out of Minneapolis, and I said, and he said, the captain, the aircraft commander said, if you want to be in the cockpit on landing, since this is a special event, fine. And I'm already up in the upper level of the C-5. I said, well, I'm already up here. He said, no, down below. So I went back downstairs and into the cargo area, climbed up, went into the cockpit, and this is all against safety regulations and everything else, but it was the most special fun thing I've ever done.
So you got in the SR-71 as it's being flown to Minneapolis. That's pretty cool.
I said, I think I'm the only person in the world to have been in the cockpit of a Blackbird at 33,000 feet at Mach 0.72 inside another airplane. And he just laughed. He said, I should issue a Mach 3 card. He never did, but it was a wonderful gesture.
Jimbo, it's great to talk to you. A friend of yours, Pat from Iowa City, who made the trip to the Boneyard in Arizona, is one of our lines, but we're out of time, but he wanted to say hi. The Blackbird book, the B-2 book, beautiful stuff. Just great photos, great text. Appreciate your work on these. I hope people will check them out. Jim, it's always good to talk to you.
And it's a pleasure, and I hope to see you next time I'm in Vegas.
I do, too. And we've got links to Jim's works on the Coast to Coast website. In a moment, we shift gears. The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist coming up here on Coast to Coast AM.